Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
welcome to Into the Darkness. I am Pam Ray. With me, as always, my co-host, Intimidus Rex. Rex and I are poets on a website called All Poetry with a group of poets called Late Night Poets. You don't have to belong to the group or the website to call in, to listen, to share, and enjoy, but it is highly recommended. Tonight is our Dark Poetry Night. It is also an after midnight show, which means while we do not allow for smut or porn or overly graphic violence, we do allow for a bit more adult content. If that is not your cup of tea, then please check out our other shows. We have up to 2 shows per night on a variety of styles of topics and poetry, something to suit everybody's taste. Now, for tonight's show, Rex and I ran a couple of contests with picture prompts, of course, it's difficult to describe the pictures, but I will tell you that people were wonderfully inspired by them, and we've got some excellent dark rites to go through tonight and to read and comment on, and I'm looking forward to that. Also, when you get a chance, make sure to go to Amazon.com and check out the anthologies, poetry anthologies put out by Late Night Poets, because when you purchase those, you not only get amazing poetry, you help support these radio shows. And hello, Rex.
Good evening.
And how are you this fine evening?
All right.
Awesome sauce. Awesome sauce. I'm glad to hear that. Are you looking forward to going into the darkness tonight?
Absolutely. Darkness
very
dwells,
cool.
Where death lurks long.
Very cool. Me too. Me too. I like, the thing I like about offering up picture prompts is to see the different directions people will take the same pictures, the same artwork. The first artwork we had up I found really intriguing. It had almost a sci-fi vibe to it. It was a creature that was a mother and her children up in like a rainforest type trees, only these creatures, their heads basically look almost like wasp nests. And I thought that was really cool. And then the other one kind of had a young girl in the rain that was very much like a demon or a fallen angel, and with red eyes and very sad look. And that's very cool to see. Now, the thing with these two contests is because I needed the room, judged them both before the show. I don't usually like doing that. But in this case, I had to, and it wasn't easy to judge because there was a lot of good quality dark rites. All right. And with that being said, we'll go ahead and get the ball rolling. And up first. Oh, yeah, and I'm going to go ahead and go back and forth between the two contests, just so you know, is When the Silence Has Awoken by Thomas and Rex. Will you give that a read, please?
All righty. When the Silence Has Awoken by Thomas B. Jungles hold secrets tangled in roots and vines. Lost secrets, back alleys taken by the divine, forgotten, until someone stumbles across these cul-de-sacs of time, awakens what best should be allowed to sleep. Explorers laugh when danger is mentioned. The question of death is part of the thrill. Horror is over the horizon. What lies unseen breeds into the quiet. The nerves tickled quickly, forgotten. Where they camped appeared to be in Eden. After fighting miles of swamp, gifts are taken. Off too quickly, we forget what else may love a garden. What is called home may resent what intrudes. The archetype of human used by many efforts to find intelligence. Intelligence uses every and any surface to find a way to add thoughts together. Bees dance for directions, but listen to the queen for guidance and production. This island was the heart of the hive. Fresh meat for babes. was how these wondrous creatures survived. The few who fled in time came back to our civilization, the horror still etched upon their souls and revealed on their faces. They spoke of the buzzing, and their pictures upon their phones only showed a stirring of hives. Those who listened laughed when they said, "They're alive." Everyone knew it was probably a mushroom bloom. Little did they believe that an island was awakened. The hive knew there was bounty beyond the swamp, soft creatures who would feed the larva, waiting to awake. The few who knew fled the hospital, fled the state, afraid to sleep, and afraid they could not go far enough from where nightmares wait. And poem.
Great read there, Rex. I especially liked your emphasis on "they're alive." What a wonderful read all the way through. I really thought this was just wonderful, dark, epic storytelling. It had some of that classic feel to the kind of the horror sci-fi genre. You know, the explorers that go out into the wilderness, and you know, that the whole, you know, it's always the whole idea that those things that we doubt that come true, those things that whisper and are those urban legends and those myths that turn out to be have that hint of truth to them. I liked that part. I also like intelligence uses every and any surface to find a way to add thoughts together. Bees dance for direction, but listen to the queen for guidance and production. This island was the heart of the hive. You know, fresh meat for babies was how these wondrous creatures survived. I like the dark element and the idea that there here's these creatures that are surviving on this island, and all they're really doing is just caring for their babies, and it just happens to be the unfortunate luck of the explorers who come across this island with their sense of doubt. And the ending was great, too. And everyone knew it was probably a mushroom's bloom. Little did they believe that the island was awake, and the hive knew that there was a bounty beyond the swamp. Afraid to sleep and afraid they could not go far enough from where nightmares wait. I thought that was a powerful line to end on, from where nightmares wait. Because there's to me, that idea that there's not only the creatures that are portrayed in the artwork, but also so much more within the depths of that forest and within the heart of that island. So excellent storytelling, very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, there's a kind of a theme, a cross between the island of Dr. Moreau and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, especially that last line. Afraid to sleep and afraid they could not go far enough from where nightmares wait. And that nightmare is in that that quickening of being taken for something else. But what with the Dr. Moreau angle was the description, the bees, and that which you've got the hive mentality rolling through. But they're a little bit more than bees because they dine on fresh meat rather than the flora. So they're definitely fauna-based. It's a different tack for it. I like that. And they're alive thing. That kind of points to the being those sacks. They're still alive, yet they're not alive in the same sense as we know.
I like that. And you're right. It does kind of have that the Island of Dr. Moreau type feel to it. And as you mentioned, they're alive, but not in the same way. So excellent observation. I like that. All right. And let me see. I know Wayne is supposed to be calling in, but so far I don't see him. Unfortunately, sometimes people get mixed up about after midnight shows, like when they exactly are. Time can be a confusing thing right after midnight. So, all right. And up next is From Dusk Till Dawn by Nose Ring Poems. And it goes like this. Umbra has its own original heiress trapped in Ignis Novice Caveter, motioning within own iris canon, amongst mortalis spheres, gray stares, whispering spells of dark scarlet, ichor, lascivious appetite, manuscript of lunatic hunger, striking out spiral tentacles, breakdown of bubbling as mystic thirst, crawling point towards inner suffocation screams, kiss of hunt as they slumber takes over innocent birth, streaming silent feet, walking street of deadened and alienated zones, sinners prey, ghost buzz of fang and jest, piercing skin, shrooting veins, loophole, cannot escape allure of vampirism, predators with mass jugular phantoms black, corpse shredding, shells glow, tinted reddened orbs, awakening sanguine nerves, moon moans to haunting whirlwinds of demons, feverishly craving kaleal blood potion, bleeding tsunami, vacuums, caskets, frame yens, tang of gore stains, ovulating on tongue for soil's crack. Strains, quantum, like harbor nightmare, grieving, chill, tormenting, ulceric damnation, feral beasts underneath battling bane, zeal, invisibilis worms of howling, night skies are broken, clock of crimson limb, mutatis, flogging realm, frost and grid of withering deep roots, ashes, chamber, bladed core, crownless again, husk of hellfire, unquenchable moonlight desolados, crooked halo with dusky najar wings, coated from Mundus realm, orbital flame of dragon ink, dripping frill, soaked in carnage of massacre thrill, devoured flesh, hook, and grapnel, clapper, claw, bark, disc, forgetting trail, stripping, bludgeon bow of clippers, charred scroll, shallot space, swallowing pace of Mary Poplar, popsicled into Mistrich novella, neat skeletal luna tucked in Argonist pocket, creases in Arden's flamous, hypnotic oculus, breeding, incubus, silicosi, sprouts, coarse within densest cramps, tomb rent, ghastly sucking ichor of earthly race, shadows of night, breathing, dusk until dawn. End poem. All right, and Rex, your thoughts.
Well, I like the pick. And the woven tail out of that pick, and hits on a couple of thoughts. The ease of walking through a city and taking what you want because nobody notices anything anymore anyway. But there's an old, before she even dipped into the vampire thought down near the middle, I was already sitting on that angle because of hit on mortalis figures, gray stairs, whispering spells of dark scarlet, ichor of lascivious appetite. I already knew right there she's this is somebody who's walking around looking for to fulfill that blood hunger that's already welling to the surface. And then again, the kiss of hunt as the slumber takes over innocent birth, streaming silent feet, walking street of dead and alienated zones. The streaming silent feet, that's the ease of the vampire walking through and not making a sound. And then she drops in vampirism on the next thought. But also, down the bottom, she hits on another thought with horse within densest cramps, tomb rent, ghastly sucking ichor of earthy race. So she's painting the fact that it's easy to take that which they are because they are also sucking up the ichor from the earth itself, so that there's no qualm about taking whomever, because they are a blight to the planet itself. So she feels no qualms about ingesting nor taking the life which she feeds upon.
I like that. I like that. And you're right. You're right. There is that kind of that blood hunger, and that really about having no qualms. And I think that's one of the things I really like about this rite, is the fact that this person, this creature, doesn't hold back on on their hunger, their lust for blood. You know, they don't hold back. They don't deny what they are and what they desire. And of course, as always, Nose Ring Poems has beautiful use of language, and always impressive. And I really like corpse shedding shells, glow tinted red and orbs, awakening sanguine nerves, moon moans, the haunting whirlwind of demons. And within those lines, to me, is that sense of that hunger that we spoke of. That, and it's that calling. That's the whole. As the moon rises and the blood speaks to you, there's that calling. Beautiful, abstract and surrealist type imagery that really brings you into that dark and haunting world. So I think that's very well done. And I'm going to go ahead and bring somebody on. I'd like to say welcome to Robbie's Poetry. And we're just going to go ahead and call you Robbie. So welcome, Robbie. Glad you could join us. Are you on mute? Uh-oh. I don't know.
Hello?
There you are. Welcome. Glad you could join us. Are you there?
Yeah. Oh, something happened there with my connection at first. Do you hear me now?
Oh, okay. Yes. Yes, we can hear you now. All right. Very glad you could join us.
Oh, I think I'm getting another glitch on my phone here where I can hear on my end, but you can't hear on my end. I had a glitch with my phone before, so I might have to try it again.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll let him try again, and we'll just
sorry about that.
Go ahead.
All right.
No problem. No problem. All right, so I don't know if that means, what exactly that means, that he can't hear us.
Well, if he's listening,
yes,
and he's still listening, turn down the sound on the radio first. That way you don't get the lag in between.
Oh, yeah, he dropped. That's what he did. I'll let him know if he called back. Also, I'm going to put the link to the topic board, so onto the... let me tell him that. Why don't you go ahead and talk about your upcoming show?
Well, let's see. That would be the Surrealistic Muse. It features I Am the Walrus by the Beatles, but it's also going to hit on the other half of Dr. John's Right Place, Wrong Time, because that kind of walks in a surrealistic realm too. So my guess is between the two, I'm going to have this one and finish off the I Am the Walrus the following week as well.
All right. All right. Well, I tell you, those are a couple
of
great songs.
The two.
Yeah, wow. Well, yeah, those are definitely going to be a couple of fun shows that I'm looking forward to. And very cool, very cool. Thank you for letting us know about that. All right. And, okay, I see he hasn't called back, and that's okay. He'll, can call back when he's ready to, and hopefully, you know, but yeah, you made a good point there, Rex. When people call in, they have to not be listening to the show because it does cause feedback. So, all right. And now we'll go ahead and move on to the next rite. And that will be... As soon as I get back into the room. And, man, I tell you, we've actually had two callers tonight. The first one got scared away, even though I was perfectly nice. Sometimes people just get nervous, and sometimes I'm not nice. But in this case, I was. And the other one seems to have technical problems. All right. Well, up next is Flesh Feasts Upon Dry Bone by John Coe. And Rex, go ahead, give that a read.
Flesh Feasts Upon Dry Bone by John Coe. The beehive culture saps its young, extracting glucose from skull bone, from which much inner sense have sprung as lifeless bleeds itself to clone. Each intermingling parasite procreates its mirrored beast, like cracks as brittle vein calcite, luring egos unto their feast. A mother's hug as good as death, contorting father's crusted leer, with tendon snap to take one's breath, arteries burst, congealing fear. Bees buzz their bonnet-chambered brains, with ticking cog-stuck honeycombs, embalming scars with rusted chains, and peeling skid-fed cyclostomes. Beneath such caverns driven root, inspiring entities nearby, milkweed suckles on its hirsute, evolving animals bone dry. End poem.
That was an excellent read there, Rex. I really like this one. First of all, John Coe, it's good to see his poetry. He's one of my favorite rhyming poets. Always very welcoming and, you know, just a nice person all around. And, what was I thinking? But this poem, what I really like is his, besides the spot-on rhyme and meter, is his use of the language and imagery that he chose, and that he really told a story within not a particularly long poem, with the four-line stanzas only being a few of them. I like that he went with extracting glucose from skull bones, rather than just saying blood, and really went into that vivid detail with making it from the skull. I also really liked luring eagles unto their feast. So the whole idea being that they're luring those who they will consume, but the people that they're consuming, they're appealing to their egos. And right there you have a nice social commentary on how the ego of mankind is often their downfall. I also like how it's kind of got some really kind of surrealistic type imagery with bees buzz their bonnet chambered brains, the ticking cog, stuck honeycombs, embalming scars with rusted chain and peeling skin fed cycles. There's something in that just kind of makes you think of that constantly, like the mind of a hunter, the mind of something that is always keeping an eye out on its prey. So just an excellent dark rite and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, this does kind of walk on that thought of societal mishaps, beehive culture, extracting glucose from skull bone, inner sense, lifeless bleed itself to clone. I thought of there's an easy thought coming out of that of you pummel someone with a certain ideology. All of a sudden, you've created like-minded clones, a cult, so to speak, which is kind of what this walks along. And then they go parasitical as now you need to move on to the next veined bit of calcite and ruin that one. The egos unto their feast. Those who sit up high have now they're gathering more and more. And the mother's hug, boy, that's a nice touch of, and contorting father's crested leer. You can see you got the mother-father figure wrapped in here as well. And I like the thought the bees buzz their bonnet-chambered brains as that constant, almost white noise thought running through them. Embalming scars with rusted chains and peeling skin fed cyclist on. Boy, great language. Evolving animals bone dry. So that runs down to the back end of thought where evolution is now not coming to bear as things are regressing.
I like that. I like that. I like that you brought up the whole, the mind, the cult-like mindset, you know, and the hive-like mindset. And also, you're right, there is kind of that, now all of a sudden I'm blanking out, but there was another part you said that really clicked with me, but unfortunately it blew out of my brain. But, great observation there on the mind, the hive-like mindset. And, all right, you know what I realize I've been doing, and I've got to change things up, is I'm having us go back and forth one right at a time to where you're always reading from contest number one, and I'm always reading from contest number two. So I'm going to change things up a little bit. I'm going to have us each read a write from, you know, the same contest, and then on to the next one because, well, I just don't feel like people from contest numbers two should all be punished and have to listen to me read their rights. So being said, I'm going to go ahead and grab another one. And we're going to hold off on Wayne's just in case. And all right, let's see here. Do we have people calling back? Not yet. Okay. All right. All right. Oh, there's Victoria. Hi, Victoria. Good to see you. And all right. This is Crawlers by John Diamond. And it goes like this. Light stutters and slacks, slips under an ancient nightgown. Gore and ghost rise to pin back eyes. Plaster cast crawlers take over the wards of dreamers. The nurse is buried in her people's magazine. She does not see the shadows reach to seal her coffin. Tunnels arrive like mouths. Enter the breath-bereft pyramid robbers, moth-eaten eyes pinned to their extinct skulls. They want to steal your darkness, weave it into nightmares, ride you like a seahorse in an oily, turgid ocean until you sink all your wishbones too deep for any hope. End poem. And Rex, your thoughts.
Couple. I like that opening thought. Light stutters and slacks, slips under an ancient nightgown. That's kind of a nice opening quality there. Lends a kind of a grim undertone and also intimates a little else. The gore and ghast, I like that thought. Plaster cast crawlers. Now that nurse is buried deep in her people's magazine, she does not see the shadows reaching the seal of the coffin. There's that notated thought of no one ever sees the darkness which comes to take you in those hours. Not enter the breath bereft pyramid robbers, moth-eaten eyes pinned to the extinct skulls. That had me thinking of scarabs, those flesh-eating beetles that one could stick in a tomb with a live body and have it eaten into oblivion until there's nothing left. Except maybe the the shells of beetles long since extinct because they had nothing else to feed upon.
Ooh, I like that. Like the movie The Mummy with that scene where the scarab beetles just pour over that guy and strip him within seconds.
Yeah, apparently that was one of the worst things you could do to somebody who did something that went against the law or canon of the realm. And that was put him alive with the scarabs in the coffin. Hell of a way to go.
That would make sense. It looks like one that could be one of the scariest things, the cruelest things you could do to somebody. I would think that piranhas would come into a pretty close second, although they obviously didn't have piranhas. Well, did they have piranhas in ancient Egypt? I suppose they probably did, actually.
No, piranhas are South American.
Oh,
but
okay.
Besides, piranhas,
that's...
hey, where if those beetles would have be feasting on you for over a period of time? Piranhas, you'll be gone except for bones in 5-10 minutes max.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. There was one time I was watching this nature special, and this capybara, as you probably know, is like one of the largest rodents on Earth. It went into the water. So it's like a good-sized medium dog, and it went into the water, and, yeah, it was, like, torn apart within seconds. So those things are vicious, and they move fast. But excellent comment there. And, yeah, I really like the way he went with this, that, you know, he didn't, you know, I like when people don't just describe a picture. I like when they get something out of it. I like that we have that idea that darkness that sneaks up on people. And the nurse buried in her People's magazine, she does not see the shadow reaching to seal her coffin, tells arrive like moths. You know, it's kind of that the whole idea of the ignorance of being so completely unaware of the evil around you. I also really was amused with the imagery, ride you like a seahorse in an oily, turgid ocean until you sink all your wishbones too deep for any hope. You know, I thought that was the whole idea of just being used into the point that there is nothing left of you that feels like it's human or has any hope. So I thought that was a really intriguing part and very well done. All right. Now, the question is did I pick up the next poem? And, all right. Nope, I did not. Then I'll go grab the next one. And long ago. So, what was the next one? I see Robbie put a right on the board, so that's good. If he's not having phone problems, of course, he's welcome to call in. And, in fact, if anybody wanted to call in, the number is 657-383-0024. And dark poetry readers and commenters are welcome. So, all right. Okay, I see what my problem is. Okay, here we go. Got where I need to be. And I see Manuel, so
yep.
Hello,
Manuel. Manuel just hit the board.
Yeah, good to see her, good to see her. All right, up next is Mystique Madeline by Rich F. and Rex. Go ahead and read that.
Mystique Madeline by Rich F. Quarks and queen of darkness, wanton whispers from another place, wandered for eternity, horizons hunted to infinity, joy and utter sorrow etched upon her phantasm face. Fickle fate delirious, martial Mars imperious, madam so mysterious, multiverse moon moaning, making cosmic waves, her space-time canvas tattered, torn. She enters our corner of the galaxy, gracefully, graciously through the time-slipped tear, and heart ripped out, she sheds her cries, a single solitary crimson tear, shivering, quivering, knowing neither hope nor fear. Now look into her scarlet sanguine eyes, tell me, what do you see? A mystique, misplaced Madeline, out of time and space, not of our time or place, lost and helpless, does not belong here, omnipresent and omnipotent, esoteric enigma, why is she here? Wearily watching over us, our misty imperfections written bold, reflected in her tattered, tortured eyes that flit and float and orb across the skies, she asks herself, why am I here? To view these hopeless humans with their choking cars and battleground bars, eternal wasteland wanton wars. She sobs and sows her seeds into the darkened Gaia night sky, casts a bounty beads of hope, asks herself, can I really make a difference to the narrow, shallow lives of these mortal fools? Her task complete, this accidental visitor, tourist from another time slot, alternative distant astronome. Tis time now, mystique Madeline, to summon the sky spirits of space and time to take you back to your home. End poem.
Greatly there, Rex. And as always, Rich has just some wonderful alliteration, rhyme, and flow. I really like that he went with the idea of a creature from another dimension that comes into our world. And it's really obvious that she's very, very misplaced, that she doesn't belong here. And in fact, that he mentions, you know, that she's lost and helpless, does not belong here. Omnipresent, omnipotent, historic enigma. Why is she here? And ask that question. It adds that sense of mystery. And it becomes your sympathies, or at least mine, go towards this creature, this being that's lost, that is pulled to somewhere where she doesn't feel like she belongs. And wearily watching over us, I like that. Ask yourself, can I really make a difference to the narrow, shallow lives of all these mortal fools? The task complete, the accidental visitor, tourist from another time slot. I mean, wow, just absolutely excellent, dark sci-fi. And with that, you know, that moral lesson, that social lesson of are there higher powers out there? Are there gods out there or intelligent life that looks down at all our moral foolishness and wonders, you know, can I help them? I thought this was just an excellent write and very well done. And your thoughts, Rex?
That last stanza that kind of does it for me. It hints on sky spirits of space and time and alien home. But I don't get the initial thought of alien, so to speak. At the time slot, that might be just the transference from one of the multiverses. But he puts in this sort of this accidental visitor. I get more of an impression because of the questions asked and the views seen. This is more of an accidental tourist, one who got thrown into this realm for one reason or another, and she's viewing everything from her point of view and taking note of it. It's almost like watching the animals at the zoo. What the hell is going on? Why am I here? And then there's a thought, tell me, what do you see? The mystique, misplaced Madeline kind of hits on the sort of, maybe she's a transcendentalist can walk across realms through a mind, and this is a thought, why have I come here to see this? I was looking at something else. That's where that accidental tourist kind of walks in.
Yeah, I like that thought. I'm thinking maybe it's the whole idea of fate. Like maybe she was accidentally pulled there, or so-called, like I put accidents in quotes, but it's the whole idea that nothing is truly an accident. That, or at least that's how this character sees it, that, you know, this creation in the story sees it as the idea what has happened to her must have a purpose, and so therefore she seeks to find that purpose. But that's an excellent thought there. I like that. Well said there, Rex. And hey, Victoria, welcome. Glad you could join us.
Hey, Kim. How are you guys?
Oh, doing
great. Did you bring your bloated saprobatches, previous pubescent pupae with you?
Well, maybe, but only for you, Rex.
Hey, remember, those big fatties offer up nice crunch and much protein.
Well, when they're that young, they don't always quite have the delicious crunch that we seek, but maybe more like a gummy bear.
Well, yes, because at that young age, they offer a little bit more sweet taste. They're not quite as biting.
Exactly. Oh, Rex, you're wonderful. Oh, well, I'm going to jump in this. I did get to hear this poem. I'm just going to assume you want me to comment because I'm that way. And I actually really agree with Rex. I think that this really is like someone who upon happenstance found themselves where they're not supposed to be. The idea that they're omnipresent and omnipotent gives an idea that perhaps this is an area that they do not know. And to me, it's really interesting that there is in fact those words, omnipresent, omnipotent, and yet they are not all-knowing. They're just always there. And even with being all powerful, they still had this fluke. And so they are left wondering why they've been brought here, wondering why they're supposed to have an impact on people whose lives are so finite that they cannot understand the error of their ways, the way in which we pollute the world that we live in, the wars that we wage against each other when there is something so much grander. So she sprinkles seeds, ideas of hope, and it kind of reminds me of the biblical verse that faith is like a mustard seed. It's small and it's tiny, and yet when it's taken care of, it blooms into a large plant. And so to me, this kind of gives me an idea of that hope, that she doesn't know what difference she is going to make. She doesn't know why she was brought here, because there's no way she can ever imbue the knowledge that she has into us finite mortals. And yet she still tries. She leaves her little seeds upon our world and hopes that in time something will take root and bloom. It tells a really beautiful story of someone who we would probably view as so much greater and knowledgeable and more wise than we are. And yet it also shows a humanity in it, because so many times we too ponder upon our purpose. And here is someone all present, all powerful, and still does not know why they are here. It's really, really an interesting piece, and I just love the story.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you're right. It does add that touch of humanity to the story. So very well said there. And all right. Up next, we have Arcane by Robbie's Poetry. And Victoria, would you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. So this is Arcane by Robbie's Poetry. Arcane felt her sorrow from daring to show the gods as they are. Just before her arachnid form, her human form turned dark and primal, like the qualities she put to the gods she dared to put on trial through art. She wonders if it was worth it all to show the faults of gods, as she sought to win the contest with a goddess of who could weave the finer weave. She thought to shower her skill by weaving a tale of gods and goddesses most true. Alas, She knew not the cruelty of those beings as she felt her body wither away, becoming arachnid in form, now spinning, always spinning a web to catch her prey. Maybe she will become human again, once more, someday, but not today. End poem.
Great read there, Victoria, and thank you, Robbie, for sharing that with us. I see that he just whipped that up and posted it 22 minutes ago, so very cool. And your thoughts, Rex?
There's some brutality in the thought offered. Arachne felt her sorrow for daring to show the gods as they are. There's that note right up top. It tells you where it's going. But what hit me was as she sought to win the contest with the goddess of who could weave the finer weave, she thought to show her skill by weaving a tale of gods and goddesses most true. And then, alas, again, that note to the opening line. But I thought that weave right there kind of hit on that notation of there's a thought that Shakespeare in there. You can only go too far before that farness actually gives you what you desire, at least. That is being well known for something that you're not. And in this case, Arachne becomes that which now bears her name evermore, the spider, an arachnid. And she's hitting on the thought of, on that bottom line of maybe one day actually being maybe forgiven or having some other entity, lower god, bring her back to what she once was, which was a human form, probably beautiful as most of these fatally flawed gods who end themselves up on the back end of things are usually beautiful to begin with.
That is a really good point. Like Medusa. Medusa is well known for having been beautiful.
Yep.
I have to agree when you mentioned that part. That was, it was really intriguing. And then the whole idea of having the ending where maybe she'll become human again once more someday, but not today. That whole idea of maybe someday there will be that forgiveness. So excellent observation there. And Victoria, your thoughts? Your thoughts?
So this to me definitely reflected the Greek story of Arachne, which was a woman who was in a competition with Athena to weave of a finer weave than her, and Athena became mad and turned her into a spider. And so I see where the story really is held to by Robert here, but it also reminds me of how so many Greek gods truly did, in all the mythos, truly did view humans as a game. We were pawns in a game of chess against each other, and any time a human proved themselves better, more beautiful, more desirable than a god or a goddess, often they were wiped out. Echo was a consort of Zeus. She was a nymph, and because she would, what was it? I'm trying to remember her whole story, but Echo would basically echo. I don't know if it was Jupiter in a lake, but the reason that there is an echo is because Echo was eventually turned into her namesake. Arachne was turned into her namesake. Lemia was turned into the first vampire. Humans did not get to stay human when the gods felt that they had done something, be it Hera mad because Zeus had had another affair, Arachne was doing a finer weave than Athena, someone was more beautiful than, I'm like totally spacing names today, and Greek mythology is one of my favorite, but anyway, Aphrodite. And so the problem with the Greek gods, and as Arachne tried to prove, was that they truly were not loving and kind. You might have your god or your goddess that you worshiped under, but ultimately you were a pawn. You were never going to be important enough for them to ever respect you or care for you. And in this, it shows that someone who tried to weave a tapestry to show the cruelty of the gods, and yet that skill was taken away, the ability to weave a tapestry to show they were left with white silk. That's only good for catching prey. The mother of spiders would be demeaned of her humanity, of her form, into a creature that people feared and drew away from, all because she bettered a goddess. It's a really, really interesting rite, the idea of wanting to return to a human form, because it shows how truly we attach our identity to our, these bodies that we wear. And yet it too shows how cruel sometimes fate and the gods can be. A really, really interesting take on the Greek story. I quite enjoy it.
Absolutely. Absolutely well said there. I like how you touched on the fact that in the Greek mythology and really in several mythologies, people are pawns at the whims of the gods. And that is a really good point there, Victoria. And I really, what I like about this is it's a retelling of a classic tale, but, you know, he brings up some very good points in the idea, like when she says she wonders if it was worth it all to show the faults of the gods. You know, I think, you know, that can be relatable to even nowadays when you take those moments to stand up for something that you believe in or someone you believe in, or, you know, or to show a wrong that's going on. And, you know, it just, and then you just wonder if it was worth it. And the other part I like this all the way through, but another part I particularly am drawn to is the fact that she was a weaver who was weaving the portrait of the story, you know, of what the gods were really like. And I think to me that really says something about how throughout history it has been the artists and the poets that have passed on from generation to generation the stories with the values and the morals of that particular, you know, society, so, or what they believe that particular society should have. I thought this was just wonderful and thought-provoking. I'm glad Robbie was able to share it with us. And I'm hoping he actually had called in a second time, but his phone line dropped. He said that it's probably because Aragne cursed the phone lines. And I said, well, hopefully next time the curse will be lifted and he can call in and join us. So. And all right, awkward moment of silence. So we will move on.
Not awkward. I was on mute, but I was giggling, Pam. Oh. That was beautiful with the Arachne curse, the phone lines. I was just trying to be respectful.
Okay. I'm just, like, talking to myself and, you know, everybody's in
completely
silent. Like, just let the crazy woman talk. Just let the crazy woman talk to herself.
I mean, when you're talking about spider curse and the phone lines, we're all a little crazy, aren't we? Oh, but no, I'm actually trying. I have a newfound appreciation for Rex and all the other hosts that do the whole show on their phone, because usually I, like, camp up at my desk and just keep my phone on and I can, like, have my desk up. And right now I'm sitting in my downstairs trying to do all this on my phone. I'm like, holy crap, you guys, this is so hard.
Yeah.
Such a new appreciation for you guys.
Right. Well, thankfully I have a tablet, which is a little better than a phone. But, yeah, kudos to people like Rex who do shows on their phone. Of course, people like Rex can do shows on his phone if he didn't have people like me. But, you know, we'll just point that little fact out there.
Well, I figured out another thing I can use, so, haha. I might be getting a little quicker now.
Oh, really? Awesome. What did you... Very cool. Very cool. Oh, nice.
Don't give away trade secrets on air, Pam. Don't give them away.
Don't give them away.
Oh, no, this one's easy. I figured out I can open up a second tag or whatever the hell they call it, tab, and stick the page up with all the rights on that one, and then I can toggle between the two because it's easier. I found that.
Nice.
Oh, that's genius.
Nice. Very cool. All right. Well, up next is Riza by Mamia, and it goes like this. The hunger gnaws at her, incessant in its mutterings. Craving for flesh, she resists the flagrant urge even as it takes over her mind, leaving her but a husk, until at last she surrenders all of herself to the hunger, and so she binges. One by one, men fell before her feet, all offering blossoms of crimson blood, which never satiated her. And so she goes, a ghoul in human guise, waiting for her next meal, her next kill, and the next thrill. End poem. All right, I like that. That was an excellent dark brevity. And Victoria, your thoughts?
So I think the only reason, this is only reminding me of it because I recently, just like in December, watched it. But there's a new TV show that is based off of the world of Cthulhu and Lovecraft. I think it's like Lovecraft Theory or something like that. And in it, Lovecraft Country. And in it, there is a Japanese demon, I think it is, that looks like a human. And when she feeds, tails come out of her and she essentially consumes them completely. Essentially, their whole body just kind of implodes to just blood as she takes their memories, she takes their life. And this really reminds me of that. And what I appreciate about it is that so often, and Mamia does such an amazing job at stuff like this, where she shows a new aspect, a new life to these creatures of lore. And in this, she really did that again. There's still that hunger, that feast, that almost enjoyment of the act. And yet, at the same time, there's this understanding of being set apart. And possibly, let me get back to the poem, possibly even a hint of humanity, because how can you consume men, consume humans, and be left unaffected by it? So she understands that her hunger gnaws at her. It's incessant in its mutterings, craving of flesh. But that verse, too, is what reminds me of the possibility that perhaps she doesn't always want to give into her hunger. What a lonely life a creature like this would lead if they would never be able to find companionship, because in the end, for love to develop, it would always have to remain at a distance. And so I'm just stunned by this, because while she waits for the next one, at the same time, it's an understanding that she will forever be alone.
Absolutely. I have to agree. And you're right. You can tell that there's a sense of humanity because this is someone who struggles with the dark side of themselves. So very well said there. And Rex, your thoughts?
Goulet. She hits on that note. The hunger gnaws are incessant in its mutterings, craving for flesh. That is definitely a goulet or a ghoul. They do feed on the body, and they will eat the whole body in its entirety, because that's what they're made for. It hits on that really nicely. I like that thought. And then there's that second stanza. She resists the flagrant urge, but she can't. That's her nature. And even though she might want something else out of it, she can't resist her nature. So even with the thought of resisting momentarily, that only leads to the glut, the spillage over, where she'll eat an enormous amount all at once to satiate. But even that doesn't satiate, because she still has to feed more. It's an imperative of her being. Otherwise, she ends up being that which is already sometimes rotting in the ground or just dying at her feet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. And she does mention in the AN that the image made her think of Riza from the anime Tokyo Ghoul. So I've never actually seen that anime, but I think that was, very cool that she got that idea from there. And And you are right, Rex. There's that kind of that idea that her nature cannot be changed. It cannot be resisted, and it must be given into. I just think this is a wonderful dark story with the idea of that insatiable appetite that must be given into, and how she takes on that human guise and the very haunting and sad way that her entire life is just going from one kill to the next. So excellent dark right there, ma'am. Yeah, very well done. All right. Now, I actually need a few minutes, so I'm going to put up this next poem for Rex to read. And then Victoria, when he's done reading, you just go straight into commenting, okay?
Okay.
All right. Up next is Arts of Predator by Conditional. And there you go, Rex.
Arts of Predator by Conditional. The eyes. The eyes are watching, shaped by fear of man's complacent, seeking those lost from society, snatching one soul from their body. What lies? A creeper in the shadows, and when we hear its heart-aching bellow, we question if it's the wind screams out of rage, or a large animal that has now found its prey. The fearful scent leaks from the dead, screams enact in your head, shadowy figures moving behind the scenes, the art of a predator. Or you die. All that's left is a skull, a sign of the beast, a sign of your fate, and tomorrow night will be another. And poem.
So that was an amazing read. But Rex, you always have those awesome, creepy reads that you just do so well. I love it when you read crazy things. It's great. So with that being said, I think what I really like is that as a whole, this poem is really quite phenomenal, but even the leading lines into each stanza create their own kind of rhymed, like a couplet of warning. The eyes, what lies, don't fret or you die. And so what I like about this is the eyes, they're supposed to be the gateway to the soul, and yet here are those eyes that are always watching. They are seeking to find something lost from society and snatch it from their body. It almost reminds me of the horror film Jeepers Creepers, because the whole premise of that is this creature that hunts other people. And of course, you know, in the first Jeepers Creepers, they take the guy's eyes. You know, Jeepers. Creepers,
where'd you get them peepers? Jeepers,
exactly.
Creepers, where'd you get them eyes?
Exactly.
I remember that.
Exactly. And so this, like, really kind of, to me, that first stanza has both of those, not only the eyes that are always watching that you cannot get away from, but also reminiscent of that movie, because the eyes are what that whole thing is about. And, I mean, losing my eyes is a phobia of myself, so it just kind of strikes that part of me, feeling that reference. And then, of course, the second stanza, what lies, a creeper in the shadows. And when we hear its heart-aching bellow, we question if it's the wind screams out of rage or a large animal that it has now found its prey. Again, Jeepers Creepers. And what lies has two meanings to me. One, what is hiding in the dark? What is lying just beyond our vision? At the other hand, what is telling us a distruth, an untruth? The lies that we try and convince ourselves that it's fine and that we're safe. All the while, these eyes lay upon us and watch us. Of course, don't fret, because the scent is what the wolves hunt. Your fear, like Jeepers Creepers, hunts that smell. And so, if you do, you will die. And all that's left is a skull, a sign of the beast, a sign of your fate, and tomorrow night will be another. I really do feel like this captures the whole premise of that movie, Jeepers Creepers, because that creature hunted the fear. They took the eyes. They hid within the shadows, and you always try and convince yourself that that's not what's really going on. There's a lot of, to me, dual meanings in this, and that just really added to the creep factor. And to me, it was just fantastic. What do you
think,
Chris?
I like that. I got to hit off that. I like the Jeepers Creepers angle. I got to hit off that the thought with the title, Arts of a Predator. It reminds me of what someone else said right around the time of Jack the Ripper. One Oscar Wilde offered up this quote: as creative acts, there is no significant difference between art and murder. And this kind of hits me at the thought of the purity in the hunt, the purity within the predator. It knows only one thing and that which it wants, whether it's food for thought, food for itself, or just the initial act of taking the life and watching that life just burn away in the moment so you can see it, that tinge just flash out of the eyes. As you brought up the Jeepers Creepers angle, there's that notation to eyes being the, not only mirrors the soul, but you can actually watch the life spirit out of those eyes in that moment of death. And tomorrow night will be another. There's that sort of the continuing thought, the continuing angle of preying upon that which lingers in on the fringes of societal norms. Those people are easy prey because people won't miss them. People don't. People look down upon them, and they're the ones that walk most dangerously because they have so little regard for themselves and the lives they're leading. So, I like that tact as well. All right,
oh,
Pam,
it's
your turn.
Awesome. Pam might not be back with us.
All right.
Oh. Hi, Pam. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I knew if I left two long-winded commenters in charge that I would have time to do everything I needed to do and get back in time to comment. So there we go. Everything works as planned.
Like Rex is out.
But I really like this. I like how he has the two words, those separate lines separating the stanzas with the eyes, what lies, don't fret or you die. It's almost like there's a kind of a code, a caution, a lines of caution within about panicking, you know, and that the eyes are watching Creeper in the shadows. I mean, all of this, just wonderful lines all the way through, and you really get that idea of those dark things which keep in the shadows, and the idea that, you know, of fear being a trigger. I very much like that, and I also like where it says, all that left is a skull, a sign of the beast, a sign of your fate, and tomorrow night will be another. It really takes on almost a very dark spiritual idea of I'm trying to think of the word, I can't think of it, but anyways, it's almost as if these creatures from hell are coming forth at night after night and choosing new prey. Excellent dark right and very well done. And next, we have The Burrowed Earth by Blue Harrison. And Victoria, will you give that a read for us, please?
Absolutely. The Burrowed Earth by Blue Harrison. The burrowed earth where wet things eat rotted destinies. That's where I rule. Push my crown hard, prongs first into yielding sentimentalities. All around, it's deep. The wormhole kingdom, a peeping hole into she, who once was victim, sharp edges unfurled from palm while eyes searched 12 corners of lived swaddled in weighted mists of decomposition. What this fire welcomes, the burn drowning moan? I push, your stern heat pressed to my spine, and I crawl to curl against doubled moon. We both, fetal and fawn, licking dirt. I dig one-handed to exhume my skin, my song, rotting of tree I belong to, cradle some semblance of longing heard, the mooring, the tending, and the breaking, when I mouthed sun, embracing all the pieces sewed. End poem.
Great read, Victoria. And Rex, your thoughts?
All right. I like this thought up front, the burrowed earth where wet things eat rotted destinies. That's where I rule. Push my crown hard, prongs first into yielding sentimentalities. What a great opening. And the thought that the wormhole kingdom, what else we got here? Swaddled in weighted mist of decomposition. Boy, there's a nice ghouly thought rolling into this, but it's almost like she's talking about queen of the worms, queen of those destined to fulfill themselves by feasting on that which is buried beneath the ground, now left to rot one way or another. But it also hits on a thought of moon and sun. And maybe the thought with the when I mouth the sun has that offering of she once wore the veil of ruling the upper end of things, and maybe was cursed into the darkness where the moon now is that weighted figure that holds her strength to herself. She hits it with, and I crawl to curl against stubble moon, we both feeble and fallen. Licking dirt. So there's that notation for the darkness that she is drawn to and living within.
Oh, I like that. I like that. That is really well said. Yeah, you know, within this whole entire rite, I really got to me the idea the struggle to grow and how painful it is to go beyond that which holds us in. It's almost as if she's describing a tree coming out from the earth or any plant, but describing it in such a dark, like almost a metaphorical way. As you were mentioning, Rex, the idea of wanting to escape where you're from. And you're right, there is kind of that sense of almost a desire for power, for something more. This just had some wonderful imagery, and I really like sharp edges unfurled from palm while I searched 12 corners of livid swallowed in weighted mist of decomposition. That whole idea that being surrounded by death, very cool. And Victoria, your thoughts?
So I probably watched way too many or listened to way too many horror podcasts while I work. Because this reminds me of one that I listened to, or did. It's over. And I've mentioned it once on another show, but this one is the Magnus Archive. And the whole premise of it is that there are, instead of gods, there are fears. So there's the spider, because who's not afraid of being a puppet in the spider? There's the eye, who is all-seeing. But this one reminds me of the entity called the buried. And it's a manifestation of a collection of fears that deal with being trapped within a space. Claustrophobia, small spaces of being unable to breathe, and the underground in death of being at the center of everything and all is pushed down. And what is interesting about these avatars in that world is that humans come essentially their prophets, their avatar. There are very specific people. So the eye has the archivist, someone who is watching and making note but never understands. There is, you know, a puppeteer who is for the spiders. And so when the end comes and the fears rule, they each get a section of land of, to create the new world order, if you will. And in that, this reminds me of someone who possibly succumbed to the buried. The whole premise behind it is that people become buried when they are crushed down. It could be poverty. It could be debt. It could be seeking to rise above yourself and not being able to break that glass ceiling that lies above you. And so here is someone who has been pushed down and buried and crushed, and they have made a kingdom of it. They have accepted it. As she said in her stanza, let me find it. I dig one-handed to exhume my skin, my song rooting of tree I belong to, cradle some semblance of longing learned. So she's understood, this character has understood that they will never be a creature that flies. Instead, they will be the tree that's roots run deep and thrive off of the depths and the misery and the downfall of others. And eventually, with enough time, perhaps she too will mouth the sun. It's a very interesting piece. It can talk about allowing your fears to become you. It can also talk about overcoming your fears that crush you. At least that's how I take it. Sometimes we find semblance in someone being there for us, but often fears will eventually leave us alone. And so we are left with the decision. Do we fight it or do we become it? And to me, that's kind of what this poem questions. So really, really well done.
Oh, I like that. I like how you bring up that the creature has almost an awareness of self, of who they are, and then also that idea of facing our fears and whether or not, you know, we become our fear or we move past it. So excellent comment there. And all right, up next we have, let me get back, we have a Polar Babbler. All right. Up next is Hive by Babbler, and it goes like this. In a hive mind, the buzzing is incessant. Larval inklings pupate to hypotheses, eager for testing, wasping in and out, eye socket portals flying to externality, returning, tumbling with yellow saddlebags filled with food for thought. Some are royal, sublime, pregnant with possibility, the timeless workers chance a sip, inevitably abandon the mother, start the cycle from scratch, churning buttermilk, formulaic idea formation, repetitive without reference, humming in mediocrity, lauded for punctuality, regurgitating honey for another man's harvest, a bumblebee flies from pistol to pistol, collecting as he can, no sugar hoard, amassed for vandals, eating pollen in solitude, resting till tomorrow, end poem. Oh, I like that. And Victoria, your thoughts?
Absolutely. So I think what I like about this is that a hive mind is much like thinking as one. It almost reminds me of the hive mind that's represented in Cell by Stephen King. People are all madness after a virus infects their brain from a cell phone code thing. And the world just goes to hell in a handbasket. But at the end, those people infected create this hive mind. They act together. They move together. They think together for the better of the hive. And when you think about a beehive, you often don't think of it like a hive mind in a terrifying manner. But if we applied that to humans, oh, that's where it crosses the line. Because bees don't have to think of their own. They don't have to be a unique person. They are there to serve the queen as she rests pregnant with possibilities of future hives, and yet eventually another queen will be born and half the hive will mindlessly leave to help start a new one. There is no individual in a hive. There is no single bee that is more important than the other than the queen. And yet, we love to look at bumblebees as they are out seeking the nectar to turn into honey, to feed everybody else and not themselves. They grapple at the pollen to fertilize the plants around them so that this cycle continues, and yet none of it would be possible if each bee had a mind of its own, a personality, an individuality zone. And so I appreciate that there's almost a spiraling down of darkness, much the way that a hive can spiral, because if humans were a hive mind, what would that mean for us, humans that laud the idea of I am who I am and I am unique just as you are? And so then at the end, that final stanza separated out. A bumblebee flies from pistol to pistol, collecting as he can. No sugared hoard amassed for vandals, eating pollen in solitude, resting till tomorrow. It almost is a slap in the face, a return to reality, because we've been dragged so deep into this idea of a hive mind and these losses and what it would mean, that I almost feel, as the reader, I almost feel trapped into this concept of a hive mind. I almost feel drawn into it, and yet then at the end, away from the rest, I'm reminded this is just about a honeybee, a bumblebee. It feels so much more. And to me, this just really deeply speaks of the root of a fear. Why do people have to prove they are unique? Why do people have to prove they are special? And it is because we fear that we are not. And I think she really caught on to that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well said there. And Rex, your thoughts?
I'm going to go a little Star Trek. This hits on that thought of the Borg mentality and the hive mind. It's kind of it's almost cultish in its extreme, because it walks and drinks solely for the edification of itself, and any and all beings outside of that realm are meant for their destruction or initialization into that hive mind by being reconverted into that. And that's what the first half of this hit me with. Then that second half of that first stanza, tireless workers chant to sit, inevitably abandon the mother, start the cycle from scratch. Now, you could offer that up as reality opening up a new hive, but I don't think it walks that way, because the hive workers never abandon the mother. Not until a new queen emerges on the scene. She goes to a new place, and then there are those that will follow her but still keep the other hive alive as well. So then that last couple of lines, that humming in mediocrity, lorded for functionality, regurgitating honey for another man's harvest. Yeah, that other man's harvest is the queen or the one who's operating on that level. Now the second half, the bumblebee, that kind of pinpoints me after that singularity that she offered up here to those that took a chance, a sip, and off and were given a different thought, so to speak. No sugared hoard amassed by vandals. Now that thought is they're keeping it solely for themselves as a fruit of their own labors and what they can offer up as individuals, instead of having it taken from them to feed something else entirely, which would be that hive mind or the Borg mentality. So eating pollen in solitude, there's that offering of walking a lonely path to, in essence, of the self, the drum to the beating a drum to a different walk, so to speak, resting till tomorrow. That even though they might do it again, there's that touch to normality, and still with a hive reference, but walking a singular path instead of the path of that singularity within the hive itself.
I like that. I like that. And good observation with the whole Star Trek Borg thing there. Very cool.
Can I interrupt for just a second? Can I interject?
Absolutely.
So, Rex, I'm just going to say, if you think that the Borg never abandoned their queen, then you obviously did not know Seven of Nine. Because she,
I didn't get everything. I never saw every episode.
Seven of Nine was one of the main characters in Voyager. I love Star Trek. Star Trek. I love it. I agree with that. Anyway, Seven of Nine was assimilated at the age of six.
Yes.
I mean, she was raised.
I remember her.
And then brought out of the Borg and restarted the cycle of by becoming a human. So it fits. It still fits, but she technically did abandon the queen. But I just had to pick on you because I love the Borg and I love Star Trek. And
because Picard was also initiated and then retaken back out to took a little bit of time to refine himself as the starship captain again.
Oh, the Borg wanted Picard so bad. I think he was captured twice and assimilated twice.
He was supposed to be the king to their
queen. Okay, just a friendly reminder. You were supposed to do a short interjection, and this is not a Star Trek show.
Sorry, Pam. I'm sorry. I just got excited. I'm sorry. It's my bad.
I know.
Take it away.
But you're just going to have a Star Trek show so you guys can yak about Star Trek all you want. So
that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Okay, go.
It actually
go.
Is.
Okay, you got it.
All right. Now, I think you both had excellent comments, and I do love hearing you both be enthusiastic. So, I do appreciate you both. Now, I did see this differently. I kind of feel like my eyes have been opened up by your guys' comment, but I'm still sticking to my comment, which is that I really felt like it was kind of an extended metaphor for that mind which does not shut down. And the churning buttermilk, the formulaic idea formation, repetitive without reference, all of this is, to me, this kind of this metaphor for all the different thoughts that come to you. And then and also metaphors for the poetry, the writing that it comes out as. And for some of the writing that comes out, it gives a purpose. It has a purpose. It nourishes people spiritually as the honey, nourishes physically. And then others, it's just completely useless. And sometimes we don't even know what to do with a thought. And it doesn't even become a ripe. In that case, it becomes that lone bumblebee that kind of flies off and really doesn't know what to do with itself. However, I do lean towards more what you guys said because it does have a darker approach to it. And I like what you said, but I'm still sticking to my guns and saying that there's something very metaphorical here about the idea of that mind that constantly just does not shut down and all that it offers up.
So. See, I really like that perspective, though, Pam, especially when you reference the churning buttermilk, because buttermilk is made when you take cream and you turn it to the extent that all the fat is compacted into butter and you are left with buttermilk. And so the idea here to me is like almost like if you're whipping whipped cream and you daze out, you go too far, you no longer have whipped cream, you have butter and buttermilk. And so perhaps we've had this dazing, like you've mentioned, this mind that has taken us down this path, and we are left no longer with the delicious treat that we wanted, but perhaps something that's fattier but without the salt and buttermilk, which has finite uses. So I think that was a fantastic comment, Pam.
Well, thank you. I think you had a little bit there about the buttermilk. Very cool. All right. Up next, we have The Heart of Darkness, Death's Voodoo by Achromatic. And Rex, would you give that a read for us, please?
The Heart of Darkness, Death's Voodoo by She Meditates with the Fallen. Taking every one of their fatalistic marks across her body as scripture. She has become the idol the dead worship over, feeling every sadness they float along as she does, through oblivion, bleeding profusely, feeling death every day, sensually stroking her tortured soul while scrawling another name with immense hate across another vein until the phrase bleeds. Bleed away for all the useless dead that apathetically worship your self-infliction nightmares. Theirs, for me, death. And poem.
Great regrex. And Victoria, your thoughts?
Absolutely. So this to me really reads almost as a goddess of death, someone who has placed themselves into those who are fallen and depressed and dark and are contemplating oblivion and their place in it. And so here is a goddess who perhaps wanted to be something lighter, like Persephone, a goddess of spring, who was forced to enter into Hades. She now must take on this role of people who are fatalist and allow that to imprint on her body as scripture. The dead may worship over her because of her beauty and the possible life that she could provide. And yet every feeling of sadness floats into her, becomes part of her veins. And because she takes each of these names and writes it upon her arm, and I can almost see them writing along the long vein of the arm, she's bleeding profusely, feeling this land in which she was not truly meant to be in. And yet, here is where she must be. Here is where she is stuck. And so each day she tries to remind herself of each person lost, because when you are a goddess of life and you are forced to rule over death, it is a loss of self. And so eventually she falls into her nightmares. She becomes death, something she was never meant to be, and yet she has nowhere else to go. It could read as a very gothic version of Persephone's marriage to Hades, in my opinion. And yet it was so beautifully and elegantly done.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. Good observation about the Persephone. And I really like how he drew this. Like you mentioned, the sadness, the kind of like somebody who feels lost. Excellent comment there. And Rex, your thoughts?
She's an angel to or for death. And it has that kind of tone of a Valkyrie, but this one doesn't hold that high-level thought of taking those dead men from the field and delivering them unto Valhalla. This one offers that Valkyrie that has the fatalistic angle within her is the fact that she cares, and that holds her different from her other mates. So she kind of walks this world as something, and maybe she did want to be a Valkyrie at one point in time, but did not take kindly to the thought, because she has become the idol of dead worship over, and that is that thought with a Valkyrie. Those men that fall on the battlefield, being taken by a Valkyrie just so they can enter the halls of Valhalla, and then there's the thought done. That apathetically worship your self-infliction nightmares, theirs for me, death. Now, there's the other angle of that. Those that are not chosen or picked by the Valkyrie, they end up elsewhere. So you come right back to that thought of the self-infliction nightmares, theirs for me, death. There's a two-angle play. If you're going to be that Valkyrie and you take everybody off the battlefield, off of the Valhalla, that's one thing. But you're only picking and choosing, you think, those that are worthy. That's another angle played, which doesn't sit well with this one.
I like that. I like that. I like how you bring in the Nordic mythology and the whole idea of kind of having that inner struggle of like getting to where you want to be because you're not willing to play the game the way others tell you to play it. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing there, but yeah, excellent comment. All right. Yeah. Go ahead and move on. We are definitely going to have carryovers, and that's all right because I don't think I'm going to get a whole lot of rights for my break on through show. Our break on through show next Friday, so we can always carry them over to there. All right. up next is Carnival Forest by Betty Page, and it goes like this. Deep into forest past the local carnival resides twisted trees. Old legend has it, people search for golden trees instead, or twisted, consumed by branches silently becoming one with twisted old trees. Myth of honeybees created so many hives, trees took on new life. Each hive had nine eyes that search for lost wanderers once consumed would grow, twisting through forests filled with absolute darkness, vivid, jet black, pure. They resist hot flames, resisting temperatures, stays completely cool. One tried to bomb them, but they splintered into more. Forests now are full, so never stray far, nor wander past into dark, for they prey on souls. End poem. All right, and Rex, your thoughts?
Well, this has a medieval type touch to it. There is that thought to small villages full of children told their kids those Grimm's type fairy tales of what happens in the woods should you stray out after dark or alone. It's meant to hold a moral value for it. It's supposed to scare you to the point that you actually listen to your parents and you don't go wandering off into the darkness because things happen out there. It might not be the bees and the trees. It most probably be the wolves and such as that, but it is garnered to set a little fear into the young ones so they adhere to that which they're being told so they themselves can offer up the same tale when it's their turn to pass on the local lore.
Ooh, I like that. I like that. Great comment. And your thoughts, Victoria?
So this reminds me so much of the old Disney fairy tale, Enchanted Forest. The idea that there are these trees, these places that you will go into and be it consumed by the trees or swarmed by the honeybees, people make their way into it and never come quite back out. People getting lost in a forest is not new, and yet we have the Black Forest in Germany, and we have, I think it is, or where people go to commit suicide in Asia. There's just these places that for whatever reason we will enter and yet so few people leave. And the natural inclination, I think, for people is to villainize those places when in reality it just becomes this hive mindset, going back to that hinting of a bee, that people think, oh, well, if so-and-so did it, if this other person did it, if 20 other people did it, then I might as well. And for some reason, we as humans don't want to believe that we would be so unoriginal to all be drawn to die or get lost or run off in the same place over and over and over again. And so we villainize that place. We determine that there's something enchanting about it. Like a Venus flytrap, it draws us in and we're never going to escape. When in reality, we're just unoriginal. But I love that idea of someone telling a tale of a twisted forest we'll wander into that ends up preying upon the souls of those who are lost within it. It's such a fun take on something that often is a fear within our cultures, that there is this enchanted forest that will whisk us away, never to be seen again. Just really, really quite fun and dark and stunning.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. That doesn't... And what is that evil laugh for?
Oh, nothing. I'm just thinking of the mention of those two forests, the Black Forest and the Suicide Forest in Japan. But there is another one where the trees grow strangely. They're kind of curly-cued. Almost like an ornamental that's been grown that way, but these trees are growing that way au natural.
Yeah. I got wasn't there one, though, that people questioned whether or not it was actually all natural, but there's one that where people twisted it that way? I don't know. But anyway, yeah. Interesting thought there. All right.
Aha, there you go. Robbie's got that. The trees are curling in Poland. I saw that recently.
The Suicide Forest is called the Okanagan Forest. That sprung to my mind right now. The trees that curl is in Poland. Oh, okay. Okay. Cool. Cool. All right. Up next is Prisoner as Darkness Arises, and I believe it is Victoria's turn to read. Yes. So go ahead, Victoria, by Polish Queen.
All right. Prisoner as Darkness Arises by Poetess Queen. Darkness besets a faucet, discombobulating my enshrouded mind with wicked voices, germinating aphorisms over and over, draining all senses of being alive. Terror-stricken, I grimace in darkness that surrounds mind, body, and soul, rendering my heart that beats against angst amassed by his evil intentions. I cringe at shadows looming in corners as he lays by my side, wretched breath hot and fetid against my entirety. Pretentiousness in the dark, enunciating his adulations with never evanescence. Alone in the dark, I bewail of those broken promises. In darkness, tears flow crimson, casting silhouettes of him and I in the back of my mind against unseen barren walls of his dark chamber. And sleep derails efforts to dismiss his torturous torment, taking, never reciprocating as my dreams loom in dark crevices of my heart, leaving me alone to wither in the dark, awaiting still, wanting to believe his heart isn't like the darkness I read in his eyes of disdain, but refusing to release me to envisage a future of a more in the arms of another, constricted, captivated, prisoner, darkness. End poem.
Great read, Victoria. I really like this one, the whole idea of being a captive within the darkness, you know, the struggle within this right. And Rex, your thoughts?
Pain, despondency, sadness with the reality that comes forth with actually finally admitting to yourself that maybe the Crown Prince Charming that you picked is not who and what he is, but what you see within those eyes is the truth behind. And maybe there's a pinch of bitterness at not actually realizing that before letting oneself get set in this place where fear now walks along with the reality of how evil this individual is, and that those promises made were just something to get you to where he wanted you, and that was under his thumb.
Just kind of have that whole narcissistic type feel to it, with having an end game. And you're right; it's always the eyes will reveal the truth. And Victoria, your thoughts?
I feel like this is the darker side of love. More like when love has died, and yet for whatever reason, the person will not let go. Those midnight hours where you cry and you wonder why the person beside you doesn't see them or doesn't care enough to comfort you. And as you sit there and contemplate what this means, as you contemplate perhaps even how to leave, sleep overshadows you and those moments are lost. There's, unfortunately, time after time that we see with murderers where it was very much the idea of, if I can't have you, nobody can.
No one will.
And there is something in our nature, and there's kind of a hinting of that, as she mentions these crimson drops. Let me find that whole thing. where she mentions eventually
in darkness tears flow crimson.
Yes, that one. And so it's kind of that idea of perhaps in some way there is a bleeding either of love or of self or perhaps even life, because murderers typically do not want to show their actions in the day. And so this crimson comes out at night. Perhaps the sleep that overcomes her is not a true sleep, but more like the Shakespearean sleep, which contemplates death, a final sleep that she cannot leave because she will forever be his prisoner. Her soul will forever be tied to him because he has taken it, her essence, her life, and made her his to some extent. And of course, she could just be trapped, quite literally. Unfortunately, there are definitely times where someone can contest a divorce. I went through it with my ex-husband. They can contest a divorce and or don't get what they want and draw out a divorce. And you just can't get rid of them that way. So there's definitely more than one way that you can be imprisoned in a relationship. But this one just feels so much darker, as if that ability to separate isn't there, and perhaps never. Really interesting. I'm loving the work that she's putting out, but this is definitely not something I've read from her before, and is still just as marvelously macabre.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're right. You're right. It is. It's wonderfully dark and macabre. And those are some great observations there. I'm looking to see if we have any fairly short rites that can be read and commented on within a few minutes. And I think from the looks of things, I am going to choose this poem as our last one for the night. And that will be carried over either till next week or 2 weeks from tonight. So it'll either be Break On Through or the next dark show. And all right, back to Late Night Poets. Not people, just me. All right. Up next is Winter Rises by Grant G. and Rex. Go ahead, give that a read for us, please.
Winter Rises by Grant G. Winter rises, snarling, spitting spores of blight, her raging eyes, their evil, giving forest fright. She begins giggling loudly, watching trembling owls and mice. Her heart ain't one for nature. She wasn't raised that nice. Her daddy was a bastard who drank and whored at night. He'd giggle causing trouble. That man knew how to fight. Winter stops her laughing, cools her fish and turned to ice. She takes a sip of brandy laced with brown and spice. For months she's been imprisoned by all her sister's might. Now she's feeling horny, young bull she'll romp tonight. Kissing, seducing, using fingers, tongue, lips her teeth will nibble, tasting bodies tautly young. Screaming, trees shake, granite rock breaks. Gasping she lies, but orgasm she never fakes. And boom.
Great read there, Rex. I have to say, I like this brutal personification of winter, how she really has just a bitch of an attitude. And that bit of, like, very just that body humor at the end. I really appreciated that. So excellent, right? And Victoria, your thoughts?
So I think what this really reminded me of is kind of that story of there were two brothers, their dad was a drunk, and when one grows up, one will never touch alcohol, and the other is drunk always just like his daddy. And when they ask, why did you become the way you did, they always, both of them say, I watched my father. No matter what life throws at us, we have a choice. We can fall into those paths and continue on, or we can become better from it. It's all a matter of how we take things and choose to react to them. And in this, you really feel the life that she came from, the effect that it's had on her. Obviously, she's a little bit of a harder person, and some that can be appealing to others, the wild sense that we strive for. And yet at the end, there's a hinting that perhaps this harder side is more of an armor than it is of an actual person. But at least we know that, be that true or not, her orgasm will never lie.
Well said there. Well said there. I like that. And Rex, your thoughts?
I can't argue what Victoria just offered up. The thought that her daddy was a bastard who drank and whored at night. He'd giggle causing trouble. The man knew how to fight. So there is that nature versus nurture angle imposed in that thought. But Victoria said it's a matter of how you want it. But then it hits on this other phrase, for months she's been imprisoned by all her sister's might. Now she's feeling horny, young girl, she'll rob tonight. So there's that other angle of more dastardly deeds from within the family, so to speak. And the angle at the back end is that sort of how blistery she's going to be, screaming, trees shake, granite rocks breaks, gasping she lies, but orgasm she never fakes. So the thought there is the purity of the snowfall, how cold it gets, can wreak havoc across the landscape, just like what family can do within the mindscape.
Absolutely, absolutely. Both of you, excellent comments there. Thank you. All right. Well, this has been a great show. Thank you, Rex. Great show. Thank you, Victoria, for calling in. Thank you to Robbie and Manya for holding the board. And thank you to Fill My Eyes for everything she does. And thank you to everyone who wrote for the show, who is listening now or will be listening later. We appreciate you all. Our shows just wouldn't be the same without you. All right, gang, everybody, have a good night and take care.
Good night.
Good night, ladies.